Inside Lacrosse Podcast.
Welcome to the Inside Lacrosse Division 3 Podcast. I'm Zach Babbo. Today I'm talking with RIT coach Jake Kuhn. Kuhn is in his fourth year with the Tigers, and he's accrued a 49-10 record in that time, with three trips to the NCAA tournament. He's a former All-America goalie from nearby Nazareth College, where he also coached. Kuhn's current RIT squad sits at 9-2, with their only two losses, one goal games to Stevenson and Cortland, currently the best teams in the North and South, respectively. The Tigers play upstate rival Ithaca on Wednesday night. Before we get to the podcast, just want to thank everybody who's followed along this far. Make sure to check out InsideLacrosse.com as well as the Inside Lacrosse feed and the iTunes store for more of the latest Inside Lacrosse podcasts. If you have any thoughts on this one, reach out to me at zbabbo@InsideLacrosse.com or on Twitter at Zach Babbo. That's at ZACHBABO, no spaces. Now let's get to our conversation with RIT coach Jake Kuhn. All right, we're joined now by RIT coach Jake Kuhn. Coach Kuhn, kind of one of the interesting things this week for me anyway, I was working on a playoff piece for the magazine, and, you know, RIT came up a lot in conversations in terms of viable challengers in the North. Obviously, you guys got, you know, maybe have a sense of where you are in that landscape. You're doing quite well this year. You're at 9-2. Your two losses are to arguably the best team in the South and arguably the best team in the North right now. The loss to Cortland was, you know, by a goal in two overtimes. Do you have a sense of maybe where you guys are in terms of the mix of everything, or just how good you feel your current team is?
On any given day, I think we can compete with basically, you know, anyone in the North or South if the guys come to play. There are certain times that I think that if we don't come to play, we're very average. But when we do, I think we can be a dangerous group. If our offense is clicking, we're able to put some points on the board, and our defense this year is tightened up a bunch. And up the middle, we've got great play with our goalie and our faceoff guys. So I feel we're pretty strong. You know, there's some great teams out there. You know, when you talk about the North, obviously, you know, Cortland and Tufts and Stevens Tech all come to mind, and Middlebury this year. So there's certainly some great competition out there, and we're going to need to play at the top of our game to beat teams like that.
Are those kind of one-goal games, you know, a one-goal 2-OT loss to Cortland, a one-goal loss to Stevenson, you know, are those games that you can walk away feeling maybe a little good from because you stood toe-to-toe with such a powerful team, or are those games that are a little frustrating because, you know, that still almost seems to be what stratifies in D3 is there's a couple of programs that are just really, really hard to beat, and you guys got really, really close but just couldn't quite get over the hump enough?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think that for the Stevenson game, I think that was a bit more of a moral victory for us. You know, we had some question marks as far as our personnel and you know, what kind of level we were going to be playing at in 2013. And coming out of the gate playing the number two team in the country at the time, we weren't really sure what to expect. We thought we could compete, but we weren't sure. So coming out of that game, I think we took a lot of positives out of it and gave our team confidence. As far as the Cortland game, you know, I don't take any moral victory out of that one. We knew we could play with Cortland, especially after playing with Stevenson. And being up in the game late in the game, we were up two goals with, you know, a little over 3 minutes left. We should have sealed the deal, and we didn't. So that was extremely disappointing. I give Cortland credit. They fought hard and earned their win, whereas we kind of played not to lose, which was a bit disappointing. So one was a moral victory. The other certainly was frustrating.
You know, one of the interesting things when I talked to you after that Stevenson game, I got to cover that, and I thought your perspective kind of on the value of the game in terms of, you know, you mentioned it being a little bit of a moral victory that, yeah, you lost, but you stood toe-to-toe with a team like that. And in looking at overall themes of, you know, strength of schedule and playoff resumes and stuff, that a game like the Stevenson game is a great game for that kind of resume building, you know, because you – what, even if you lose, it's a great game on your schedule, and the regionality aspect too, with the fact that, you know, it's an out of region game, means if you do drop it, it won't necessarily hurt you that much in terms of seeding within your region later on in the spring. Can you maybe elaborate on any of that, or just talk about the way maybe thoughts like that come into building a schedule and setting yourself up for a playoff run later?
Yeah, I mean, you know, knowing that it wasn't going to necessarily help or hurt us, you know, it's, you know, I don't want to call it a scrimmage, but it's certainly a good test for our guys. And, you know, we ended up coming out on the losing end. So ultimately we have, you know, currently one loss in the North, which hopefully down the road will come into play. You know, and like you said, we learned from our mistakes. We learned that we could play with any team. And so overall, you know, I think it's a great contest for us, and we plan on continuing it. Moving forward, also, I think the criteria for the NCAA selection committee is going to change a bit, so that game may end up meaning more in the future. You know, as it sits now, I think it's a good test for our guys, and it lets us know where we stand, good or bad. And, you know, moving forward, hopefully it's going to help us out.
One of the interesting things you said, you know, before, we were talking about kind of how the teams rolled through this year is the development of the offense. And, I mean, that was one thing I was very kind of taken with when I saw you guys play Stevenson, is how you guys move on offense, how quick it is, and how in some ways it looks unique. I mean, you look to have a game that is very active, that's a lot of off-ball movement, that seems to incorporate a little bit of the indoor ideas in terms of the pick-and-roll games and things like that. Can you talk a little bit about what you guys try and do on the offensive end there?
Yeah, sure. You know, Coach Wilkins, my assistant coach, he does a fantastic job. He really does a nice job mixing our Canadian style kids with the American style. And, yeah, certainly the off-ball play is key. You know, we're preaching that all the time, to stay moving off-ball, and it's more difficult at times than you think. But the more we move off-ball, the more opportunities are going to arise, either off-ball or, you know, for our guys dodging and just, you know, going in one-on-one with the goalie. If you occupy off-ball, there's no slides available. So it's certainly a hybrid offense. Coach Wilkins has great experience playing with the Rattlers and the Nighthawks, and I think he, you know, he's incorporated, you know, the box game for sure. And we've got some American kids that are doing a nice job with it as well. You know, they've picked it up quick. We really have wrapped it out a lot. And, you know, we're hoping that it's a unique offense to face. So hopefully it gives teams problems.
Is it one of those things where it took a while to build that kind of an offense? I mean, it seems like a game that's very active like that. There's a certain amount of, you know, continuity and awareness that all the players need to have, since there's so much motion and there may be a lot of given looks on any given play.
Yeah, I mean, it's somewhat freelance. You know, coach certainly puts them in the right positions, and you still have to be an athlete out there and find open space and cut when you need to and don't cut when you're not supposed to. But, you know, I think it's a tough offense to defend overall. I mean, we go against it in practice quite often, and they're scoring on our D quite often too. So it's a tough offense to defend, and it certainly did take a long time to work in. It's kind of funny. I was actually the one to suggest, you know, or push on into really repping that out. And once he saw how it worked, and, you know, he kept with it and really worked the guys. So I'm going to take a little bit of credit. I joke with him about it.
You mentioned how difficult it is to defend that. In some ways, I mean, some of the conversations I was having with people in terms of possible playoff scenarios, I feel like a team like yours could be difficult for the uninitiated, because on top of the fact of the talent and all that, the fact that it's a bit of an unconventional system means it's hard to kind of game plan for, to get ready to adjust to. In some ways, it kind of reminded me of all the talk of the Syracuse 2-3 zone in NCAA basketball right now, and how, you know, look, you can think you're practicing against a scout team 2-3 zone at your own, you know, practice, but it's not the same as getting up against theirs in the tournament, and it was a large part of their success and run to the Final Four. And I guess in some ways I was trying to draw parallels between what you guys are doing offensively and that kind of an idea. I mean, can you see any validity to that maybe, or do you hope that there is some of that, I guess, in some
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say. I hope so. You know, you never know. I mean, these great teams in North or South, you know, with a fantastic defenseman that are out there, you know, if they have enough time to game plan, they'll put something together. So, you know, we hope that we stick with what we do and it works. You know, it's not the only offense we run either. We have some other stuff that Coach puts in. He has a ton of options, and I think that's the most difficult part, preparing for us, you know, defensively, because there's so many different looks that Coach has. You might think you're going to see one look, and next thing you know, it's a different look. And, you know, it's a lot of off-ball play, you know, and if you're worried about the off-ball play, then hopefully we're dodging to score. And it's tough to defend at times.
Has the offense changed at all this year, or maybe gotten a boost by some of the new rules stuff? I mean, you would think maybe some of the quick strike stuff, you know, helps offensive teams, but a lot of those kind of sets flow almost, it seems, more in the 6-on-6 than in transition. Not to say that the team isn't, you know, effective in transition as well, I guess, but, I mean, you know, the numbers you guys are putting up of 14.64 goals a game, 42.3 shots a game, you're almost 50% on the man up, but none of those are necessarily that different than, you know, years past for you. So I don't necessarily know if I can't necessarily tell if the rules, I guess, are influencing your offense or not that much.
Yeah, I don't think it's a huge difference. You know, I think that we've had a couple opportunities that, you know, we picked the ball up off the end line or the sideline and got it in play quick. This past weekend, actually, against RPI, we scored a quick goal, picking the ball up and getting it in play quick, you know, and dumping it in. So we try to take advantage of that. But it seems like now everybody's trying to play fast. So, you know, those teams that wanted to slow it down before, I think maybe that's where we excel, because we like a fast game. So, you know, it wasn't a much change for us. It almost works into our favor, I'd say. You know, same with like a team like Tufts. I mean, they're up and down. They're scoring a lot of goals. You know, they're used to it. You know, these other teams have had to adjust a bit.
You know, with that kind of up and down aggressive play, the unique kind of offense, the penchant for scoring and putting up good numbers, is that a thing that kind of helps you when you're trying to bring in kids, you know, recruit or attract people to the school? I mean, I know a lot of coaches talk about it helps to kind of play a style that kids mm-hmm. enjoy playing, that they want to get out and run and all. Is that something that has helped grow maybe the RIT program, that, you know, being a fun kind of team to watch play or play for?
I'd like to think so. You know, we certainly preach to all prospects that we try to, you know, run, gun, and play fast and play the game how we feel it's supposed to be played. And it's a, you know, a fun to be a part of. Some kids, I guess, buy into it more than others. I mean, we've lost out on a lot of recruits to different schools, but we've gotten a lot of good ones too. So I'd like to think that the guys here enjoy doing what we're doing, enjoy, you know, playing fast, enjoy, you know, scoring goals. You know, I mean, I think Coach Wilkins' offense has been in the, you know, 13 to 15 goals a game range every year. You know, so that it's been a lot of fun. And his man up has been fantastic. I mean, I think I think it was last year, maybe the year before, I forget, but he had the number one off man up in the country, and I think he tries for that every year.
You know, how important is that, or how much of an edge do you think that is to you guys, the fact that you can be so proficient in those special situations? I mean, everybody kind of talks about the importance of, you know, keeping your penalties low and all that kind of stuff, but obviously if you're not facing a team that's overly efficient on man up, maybe you don't have to worry as much about that, whereas you guys can really seem to be able to burn people if they end up in the box a lot.
Yeah, well, we set goals every year, team goals every year, and special teams are always a part of that. And, you know, we take pride on our end as well, the man down. I think this is by far the best year we've had on man down. The guys, you know, are finally really starting to get it. We've kind of been back and forth with some different schemes, and this year we kind of settled in and playing much better man down. And then, you know, Coach Wilkins is, you know, like you said, up around 50%, which is unheard of. It gives us a huge boost. We know if teams are going to follow us, we've got a good shot to score. And vice versa, we can play aggressively on defense because we know our man down is going to hold for us. And a lot of that has to do with our goalie play right now, too, for the man down. Pat's playing fantastic.
Does some of that offensive man-up success, you think, kind of tie into some of the uniqueness of the overall, you know, regular offense run? I mean, I would imagine some of the concepts of the indoor-outdoor stuff, that if it works in 6-on-6, it's obviously going to work that much better in 6-on-5, you know?
I would say I don't think he's running any pick and rolls type stuff, but he knows his stuff. He gets the guys who can score. He gets them open and puts them in a position to put the ball in the net. You know, I think that's what Sean does the best. I mean, he knows his players. He knows what their strengths are. He knows where to put them. You know, I think he's got a great coaching mind. I'm blessed to have him here.
You mentioned kind of that idea of knowing players and kind of utilizing the best. In some ways, is that how some of these kind of systems evolve? I mean, I look at your roster and you guys have, you know, it looks like nearly a dozen Canadians on the team.
Mm-hmm.
Is that one of those things where, you know, you realize the talent on the roster and you build systems that are conducive to that? Or is it more that you start to do certain things philosophically and then you go out and you procure the talent that can do that, you know, better, I guess?
I think it's a little bit of both, you know, a little bit of both. You know, having, you know, 12 Canadians, 11 Canadians, definitely sparked the idea. And then, you know, all the American kids that we have certainly, like I said, have taken well to it and understand the concept. So I think that's where the idea was sparked from. You know, listen, these guys are used to it. Let's give it a try. And the reason I brought it up to Sean was because I know that it's difficult to defend, you know, so when we talk, we're always bouncing ideas back and forth to each other. And, you know, listen, Sean, this is going to be tough to defend, especially we were more talking about it for Stevenson because they had no idea we were going to be doing it. And, you know, I said, if they have no idea, it's going to be tough to adjust in a game, you know, to pick and rolls. And, you know, it's certainly worked for us, and it has worked for us. But I think it's a little bit of both, you know, it's the personnel and the philosophy.
Obviously, you know, looking at your roster, kind of what jumped out to me when I was looking for Canadians and kind of the breakdown of personnel, you know, you guys had about a dozen Canadians, a dozen or more guys from the New York region, a lot of them from, you know, more of the upstate kind of neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
I guess in some ways, you know, how has that maybe affected the building of the team in terms of, you know, is that an intentional or causal thing of kind of taking advantage of RIT, it's in Rochester, you know, you're in kind of that area, you're close to Canada, you're in a fairly lacrosse-rich area of the, you know, the breadth of upstate New York. I mean, is that kind of one of those essential things for a school like yours to be successful, to be able to mine those kind of kids that are fairly regional?
Yeah, I mean, I love the local guys. At times, it's tough to get them or convince them to stay around home and come over here and play for us. You know, so we're not afraid to branch out either. I mean, you know, some of our better scorers, Jack Kristen's from New Hampshire, Taylor Wisman's from Seattle, Washington, Pat McMullen's from Philadelphia, you know, and then, you know, we've got kids from all over the place, but we certainly have kind of our nest egg in upstate New York and Canada, because, you know, the Canadians, we're one of the closest options for them, and their parents can come watch. Obviously, RIT is a wonderful education in all different facets, business, engineering, sciences, everything. So we've got a lot of options. So, yeah, I mean, I think we have kind of a nucleus of upstate Canadian guys, and then we'll take guys from anywhere else. I mean, if guys can play and they have good grades and can afford to come, you know, more power to them. We've got a couple more kids next year coming in, one from Denver, one from Seattle, one from Long Island, so we're branching out a little bit as well.
I was going to say, I was kind of surprised, actually, too, amongst a lot of, you know, expecting to find a lot of Canadians and New York kids. Amongst that crew, I also found a kid from Hawaii, kid from Australia,
yep.
Kid from Tennessee,
yep.
As you mentioned, players from the Washington area, San Diego. I mean, are those kind of just the random finds you get in the recruiting world these days, or kids that just end up on campus and realize they can play and bring them out to the team, or...
A little bit of both. I mean, certainly our recruiting efforts. I'm seeing kids from all over the country while I'm out recruiting all fall and summer. And, you know, a lot of these kids we recruited, they come. And really what it comes down to is the education that RIT provides. It's a very diverse place. We have all walks of life here. We have young men and women from all over the world that go to school here. So in a lot of respects, it attracts the athletes. And then when we get out and recruit them and get them on campus, they, you know, sometimes they're surprised to real, you know, find that, you know, wow, this is a great education and I can play great lacrosse on top of it. So it's a bit of both.
So I guess I can kind of use that to segue a little bit on how you ended up in Rochester. Or I guess rather at RIT, because you were kind of already in Rochester. You played your career at NAS, and you coached a little bit at NAS too. Can you talk maybe just about, you know, your experience of being at NAS and in the Rochester area? I mean, your NAS is about, what, 10, 15 miles at most away from RIT? So it's a pretty local kind of, I guess, sphere for you to exist in up there.
No doubt about it. I attended Nazareth College and then coached there for 5 years with Rob Randall. He offered me my first job, so he's actually texting me right now. But, you know, I love Rochester. I think it's a great area. It's a great city, clean city. I'm a big fan of the upstate New York region with the Finger Lakes and the outdoor life. I'm pretty big into the outdoors, so I love being up here, you know. My in-laws, my brother actually lives in Rochester. My in-laws are in the area, and my parents are still in Cortland. So everybody's close. I have a 5-year-old son now, so, you know, seeing my family is definitely a priority for me, which is a big reason why we wanted to get back to upstate New York, you know, leaving UMass. But my experience at NAS was fantastic, both as a player and as a coach. I was, like I said, blessed that Rob gave me a job coming right out of college, and we were able to compete in a championship in 2004 against Salisbury. And I just had a great experience with it, and a lot of my friends are still here, so it's like being at home.
I guess, you know, with the regionality of the two schools, and you've been a player and a coach at both. You know, can you talk a little bit about the rivalry that exists between NAS and RIT? I mean, maybe it's changed over the years from when Nazareth was in a couple of more, you know, deep playoff runs and NCAA championship games, but still the proximity and the relative competitiveness of the two programs has got to probably add some juice to that still.
No doubt about it. Still, the rivalry's still there. I mean, you know, you talk about the past and you know, in the 90s, NAS was dominating Rochester, and, you know, RIT, you know, and at least in my time, was putting up a great fight, and, you know, I think we joke about it all the time. Adam Platzer, who he still works here at RIT, he was a goaltender at RIT while I was at NAS for the 4 years. We both started against each other for 4 years, and I think we may have split 2-2, or maybe it was 3-2 NAS. But and Coach Wilkins was at RIT at the time. So this is a deep-rooted rivalry. It's never going to change as far as the competitiveness of the game. What has changed, though, is the fact that we're not in the same league anymore. So, you know, it's not like your season depends on beating NAS. So I don't want to sit here and say it's less important, because it's not. But, you know, we don't have to battle each other in league and then potentially a second time in a conference tournament, which quite honestly for me is a lot less stressful, you know, because it's my alma mater still. And I love Rob Randall and what he's doing over there. So it's a tough game for me every year, but I certainly want to win it.
Speaking of the conference change, so this is RIT's second year in the Liberty, is that it?
Yes.
And I guess, can you tell me a little about, you know, what kind of prompted that change? I mean, conference changes are, you know, very zeitgeisty right now in the college sports with football and basketball and all that stuff going on. And obviously, lots of times when schools realign, it's, you know, a lot of different factors. It's not necessarily based on one particular program or something like that. But, you know, what kind of steered the shift from RIT going from the Empire 8 into Liberty now?
From what I gather, it's mainly you know, the fact that those schools are educationally more like RIT. They're similar to RIT. You know, there's some engineering schools in there. You know, I think as far as the academic reputation, I feel that the Liberty League schools have a little higher reputation, and those are the type of schools that RIT wants to be, you know, associated with. Also, many of those programs have a hockey program competing at the Division I level, so I think that was more in sync with our Division I hockey team. And, you know, the travel is a little more expensive, but that's okay. We don't mind some bus time.
What do you think kind of just the way, you know, the coaching aspect or what have you may have changed a little bit from one conference to another in terms of, you know, you're not seeing teams you're quite as familiar with after, you know, the conference rivals that you saw every year are no longer there, and you're getting used to a new slate, a new schedule. And I guess in some ways, luckily, you get to stay in a conference that is arguably as competitive as the one you were in, instead of having to step into one that's either much harder or much easier and therefore, you know, hurt on the strength of schedule. I mean, the Liberty is still a good run.
Yeah. For lacrosse, I mean, it was a great move for us, I feel. You know, for those reasons I stated earlier, and also obviously for my personal reasons, not having to play NAS in the conference tournament. But yeah, the lacrosse is very good. You know, some great defenses in our league, I feel. You know, Union and RPI have had strong defenses every year. You know, RPI has given us serious issues every season. I mean, we finally broke away a little bit this year, but every year we've struggled to score on those guys. You know, Clarkson says they have a great goalie, a great team overall this year. You know, St. Lawrence is always at the top of the league. So the first year is certainly an adjustment, you know, trying to learn what each of the schools are all about, what they do, what the, you know, coaches' philosophies are. But once you settle in and, you know, you watch enough film, you realize what you're dealing with. And, you know, I think we've settled in pretty nicely at this point. But it is still certainly very competitive.
You mentioned about the NAS, I guess, getting a little bit of relief from not having to play NAS as much. One of the interesting things in kind of looking at your coaching trajectory is that, you know, you went from playing at NAS to coaching NAS to then going to UMass and then now to RIT. And I guess the move from NAS to UMass kind of struck me as interesting because while obviously it's a D1 opportunity and that can often be strived for, often coaches also kind of, when they can land at their alma mater, they kind of want to stay put there. I mean, can you tell me a little about that transition from Nazareth to Amherst? What maybe prompted, what you were hoping to get or what have you out of that?
Yeah. Well, plain and simple, at the time, NAS wasn't paying me very much money. You know, that's not the whole reason, but that's a big reason. I was also working as a rep at Cascade at the time, so I was, you know, carrying two jobs and I really just wanted to be a coach. And, you know, to be a top-level coach or a head coach, you need to branch out and you know, learn from some other people, you know, and learn new systems. Don't get me wrong. I like I said, I respect Rob a lot, and I love the program, always will. But I needed to, you know, take that next step for myself and you know, be a head coach at some point. So I decided I was interviewing. I interviewed at a few different places that year, Ohio State, Denver, Notre Dame called me. I had a brief interview with them. And, you know, Greg Cannella was a great guy and offered me, you know, that position. And I was really excited for it. And couldn't have done it at a better time because that first year we ended up going to the national championship. So what an experience. And Jason Miller, who's now the head coach at St. John's and doing a great job down there, he's got a great defensive mind, and I learned an awful lot from him, as well as Coach Cannella, and his, you know, how he deals with his athletes and people, and certainly his lacrosse mind as well. So, you know, I was fortunate there. Jason took a head coaching job fairly quickly, and Greg trusted me to move up in rank, and you know, before I knew it, I was the first assistant in a D1 program, and it was an awesome experience.
I guess from that experience, I mean, you talk about, you know, I would imagine a title run and all that is a lot to kind of soak in.
Mm-hmm.
But are there certain things that you found from the D1 level that you thought, boy, this would really kind of translate well over to D3? Or you know, you kind of tipped on that of certain things you soak in that help kind of grow you as a coach and learn new things. And, I mean, what did you kind of take away from experience like that helps you be a better coach now, you hope?
Yeah, well, one thing I guess I would point out is I really didn't have a set path or a set plan. You know, I wasn't sure if I wanted to be at UMass for forever. I wasn't sure if I wanted to, you know, try to move on to be a head D1 coach or, you know, try my hand at another program. I mean, that was probably unlikely, another Division I program, because I was comfortable where I was. And certainly, you know, I wasn't really thinking that D3 head job was exactly where I wanted to be either. I really didn't know. More what it came down to after I met my fiance, it was more regional. You know, we wanted to try to be back closer to home, and we were really kind of looking for whatever popped up, and RIT did pop up. So that's kind of that story. But as far as what I learned, I learned an awful lot. I watched so much film. You know, you really find, you know, figure out the intricacies of certain offenses and what defensive moves seem to counter those. And, you know, bouncing some ideas off Coach Miller and Coach Canella, it was just a learning experience overall. What I guess I didn't really care for in Division I was, you know, all the paperwork and just the cutthroat mentality that goes on in Division I. It is very cutthroat. You know, coaches are losing jobs everywhere, and you know, the recruiting is cutthroat. And I don't know. I not that I didn't like it, but I guess I feel much more comfortable now at a D3 school as a head coach and having a little more job security and you know, being a little more casual as far as the recruiting is concerned.
I was going to say, is there a certain aspect of that you can really enjoy, almost the, I guess you could slightly call it like an autonomy to the D3 game, that you see a lot of coaches that seem to be able to, you know, if they can kind of get a relative level of success and a strong reputation where they are in terms of, you know, turning out good teams, keeping up graduation rates, good kids, all that, you can kind of enjoy a little bit more of that security of just enjoying your program a little bit more and kind of carving out a nice niche for yourself to really grow as a coach and grow a program.
I think that's true. I do. I think it's true. You know, there's got to be some sort of a comfort level there, you know, and don't get me wrong. I feel that I certainly put a lot of time into this, and we're trying to compete at the highest possible level and win a national championship. So the difference isn't huge between, you know, a program like this and you know, a Division I job, I don't feel, based on my experience. But I think the job security is there as long as, you know, you have a pulse of your team and you keep a good stranglehold, I guess, on them and make sure they don't get out of hand. And you're winning games, of course, and guys are doing well academically. So as long as you're taking care of all that stuff, you know, I do feel that across the board in Division III, the security is there more than it is in Division I. You know, although, you know, like I say this, and you never know, I could be a Division I head coach someday, and I'm sure I'd be happy doing it.
And I guess, you know, as we get closer to the playoff picture here, you know, from what you know of this team and the growing of success, I mean, do you have a sense of what it takes to be able to do something like what Tufts did in 2010 and kind of break through, you know, beat the established powers in the playoffs when it counts and suddenly find yourself on a stage like the national championship and you know, finally seeing those goals right in front of you?
Yes, I kind of said this from day one with the players here. You know, when I first got here, I don't really think that it was talked about or something that they believed they could do. I think that for me as a head coach here, that was one of the biggest things that I brought to the table, was the fact that I had some championship experiences. I've participated in four championships. I won one my freshman year, and I've taken second place in three different occasions. One with UMass, one as a coach at NAS, and one as a player my sophomore year. So I've had that experience. I know what kind of work needs to be put in to make it to that level. Fortunately, at this point, I feel like my coaching mind is a lot more mature than it was when I was back at NAS after my UMass experience. And I feel that having my staff here that I have now, that we have all the pieces in place, it's just a matter of winning, you know, those important games when the game's on the line, you know, especially down the playoffs. So we're right there. We're right there. We just have to find a way to get it done.
Hey, Coach, I guess I'll wrap up with kind of an anomaly I feel I've stumbled on in some of these podcasts I'm doing. In terms of kind of combing the D3 ranks particularly, but probably it exists as a bit of a trend overall, I feel I found a lot of coaches who were also goalies, particularly good goalies at some point in their career. Do you think there's some kind of correlation? I mean, I can see maybe the idea of, you know, guys who were the field generals and things like that transitioning well to the coaching position. I mean, do you think there's something there? Maybe is something about being a goalie, particularly a top-level goalie, that helps you, you know, become a coach later on down the road?
I've had this conversation many times. Yes, I do. I do believe that. I think that you're able to sit back and see the entire field, whether the ball's on offense, whether you're, you know, clearing or riding, whether that you're playing defense, you see the whole field, and it's the only position on the field that you're able to do that. Everyone else is moving around and taking care of their responsibilities. And to an extent, there's a lot less thinking involved playing goalie than there is all these other positions. You know, I've tried the field a few times. I like getting out and playing a little bit of middie or attack on occasion just for fun. And you're constantly moving. You don't really get to see the field as much. So I think that has something to do with it. I also think that as a goaltender, there's a responsibility there, you know, to be a leader on your team. Whether you're a captain or just the goalie, you either have defensive leadership responsibilities or maybe team leadership responsibilities. So I think that certainly helps, you know, young men and women become coaches when they're finished. So those are two reasons that come to my mind that I think make a goalie a good coach.
All right, well, Coach Kuntz, thank you very much for coming on and talking to me a bit today. Best of luck as you guys step up against Ithaca on Wednesday. It'll be your last non-league game before finishing off the Liberty slate. And I have a feeling that you guys will be in the mix come the playoff hunt, so I'll be very curious to see kind of how the Tigers progress along come May.
That sounds great, Zach. I appreciate your time.
Take care.